Ayrım 14.
Sayfa 163. It is in the course of this account that a famous phrase enters the history of ethics for the first time, when Hutchison asserts that that nation is best which procures the greatest happiness for the greatest numbers, and that worst which in like manner occasions misery, and so becomes the father of utilitarianism. Footnote: An Inquiry into the Original of Our Ideas of Beauty and Virtue, 2-3. The reason why we could not hope to find any adequate answer to Mandeville in either Shaftesbury or Hutchison is fairly clear. Both of them assimilate ethics to aesthetics. Both are preoccupied with describing the character of our response to virtue's actions, rather than with clarifying the way in which moral judgments may provide us with reasons for acting in one way rather than another. Both speak from the standpoint of the critic of action rather than from that of the agent. Neither, therefore, is under pressure to provide us either with an account of how reasoning can be practical or with an adequate theory of motives. Unfortunately, although these defects are in some ways supplied by the two greatest of English 18th century moralists, Butler and Hume, they, as it were, divided the problems between them and thus solved neither of them. Butler attacks the problem of moral reasoning, but never asks, or rather, asks and answers in the sketchiest and most unsatisfactory fashion, how this kind of argument can weigh with human agents. Hume tries to supply an adequate account of motives, but leaves no proper place for moral reasoning. Nor can we, by adding Butler to Hume, supply the deficiencies of each. For what is omitted in each distorts what is supplied. Joseph Butler, 1692-1752, Bishop of Durham, denied at least two of Hutchison's central positions. He begins, in fact, from a position closer to that of Shaftesbury. We have a variety of appetites, passions, and affections. Benevolence is merely one affecting among others, which deserves its due, but no more than its due. To see it, as Hutchison did, as the whole of virtue is not merely a mistake, but a pernicious mistake. For it leads straight to the criterion of the promotion of the future happiness of mankind in general, as the criterion by which my present actions should be judged. But the use of this criterion would sanction the committal of every kind of crime or injustice, provided only that such crimes and injustices appeared likely to promote the long-run happiness of the greatest number. This objection of Butler's really falls into two parts. He believes that we cannot, in fact, be sufficiently certain of what the consequences of our action will be for us to justify present action by future consequences. And he believes that the moral character of actions is and must be independent of their consequences. To the former of these contentions, a utilitarian might well reply that the criterion of the greatest happiness only has application in so far as consequences are genuinely predictable. The argument between him and Butler then becomes a factual one as to how far consequences can reliably be predicted. The crux of the argument, therefore, lies in Butler's latter contention. Are there classes of actions which ought to be done and which ought to be prohibited, independently of and irrespective of their possible consequences? Butler's positive answer to this question is part of his total doctrine. The mistake made by philosophers as different as Mandeville and Hutcheson is that they suppose benevolence and self-love to be opposed. Self-love is the desire for our own happiness, but our natures are so constituted that part of our happiness derives from gratifying our desire to be benevolent toward others. An excessive indulgence of those appetites, which are inconsistent with benevolence, would in fact lead to our unhappiness and thus would be a denial of self-love. Nonetheless, men do give themselves up to such passions and affections, to their known prejudice and ruin, and in direct contradiction to manifest and real interest and the loudest calls of self-love. How do we avoid such prejudice and ruin? By rational reflection. It is cool or reasonable self-love that we need to guide us. But how does reasonable self-love reason? There is a superior principle of reflection or conscience in every man which distinguishes between the internal principles of his heart as well as his external actions. Footnote 15 Sermons 2:8. Reasonable self-love consists in governing our actions in conformity with a hierarchy of principles which define human nature and what is good consists in. There is no clash between duty and interest, for to perform the actions that we ought and to refrain from prohibited actions will ensure our happiness. But how do we know which actions are enjoined and which proscribed? Here the argument becomes entirely obscure because it is circular. I ought to perform those actions which will satisfy my nature as a rational and moral being. My nature as a rational and moral being is defined by reference to my adherence to certain principles. And those principles demand obedience because the actions which they enjoin will, as a matter of fact, satisfy my nature as a rational and moral being. Suppose I do not perform these actions, what then? Is Butler arguing that, as a matter of fact, if I am immoral, I will always be unhappy? Certainly, I shall be unhappy if I have a well-instructed moral reason. But I may in fact fail to recognize the authority of genuine conscience and so not be disquieted. Moreover, I may, although Butler judges this to be the exception rather than the rule, find that duty and interest do not precisely coincide, so far as life in this present world is concerned. The providence of God ensures such a coincidence in the world to come. But even though this is so, so far as the present is concerned, my duty and my happiness are not necessarily coincident. Thus, the satisfaction of my nature as a reasonable and moral being is not precisely coincident with my happiness in an empirical sense. How then does the criterion of duty manifest itself? At this point, Butler only fails to notice the circularity of his argument because he exchanges argument for rhetoric. The rhetoric is magnificent, but it remains rhetoric. Had it strength, he says, of conscience, as it has right. Had it power, as it has manifest authority, it would absolutely govern the world. Footnote 15 Sermons 2:14. What is valuable in Butler is his revival of the Greek notion of moral reasoning as determined by premises about what will or will not satisfy our nature as rational animals. What is defective is the omission of any justification for for construing our nature in the way that he does. We can trace this defect to at least two sources, Butler's theology and his individualism. The theology is pernicious because it enables him to bring in the eternal world to redress the balance of duty and interest in the temporal world. The individualism is apparent in his account of human nature, which is expressed in terms of the self-awareness of the single individual. Contrast Aristotle, whose account of human nature and what will satisfy it presupposes a social framework of a certain kind. Or if we remember Plato, whose account of justice as an inner state in which rational principle governs appetite appears to be the same type of account as Butler gives, we ought to remember that the justice of the inner state is connected with a form of life in a given type of society. Indeed, the comparison with Plato and Aristotle suggests a general diagnosis of the difficulties of 18th century English moral philosophy. Traditional European society inherited from the Greeks and from Christianity a moral vocabulary in which to judge an action good was to judge it to be the action of a good man, and to judge a man good was to judge him as manifesting dispositions, virtues, which enabled him to play a certain kind of role in a certain kind of social life. The acceptance of this kind of social life as the norm by which actions are judged is not something asserted within the moral system. It is the presupposition of there being moral judgments at all. Actual social life did, in fact, always diverge widely from the norms, but not so widely that it could not be seen as an imperfect reflection of the norms. But that breakup of the traditional forms of social life, which was produced by the rise of individualism, begotten partly by Protestantism and capitalism, made the reality of social life so divergent from the norms implied in the traditional vocabulary that all the links between duty and happiness were gradually broken. The consequence was a redefinition of the moral terms. Happiness is no longer defined in terms of satisfactions, which are understood in the light of the criteria governing a form of social life. It is defined in terms of individual psychology. Since such a psychology does not yet exist, it has to be invented. Hence, the whole apparatus of appetites, passions, inclinations, principles, which is found in every 18th century moral philosopher. Yet, in spite of all this psychological construction, happiness remains a difficult key term for moral philosophy, if only because all too often what would in an obvious sense make us happy is what in an obvious sense we ought not to do. Consequently, there is an instability in the history of the moral argument exhibited in an oscillation between attempts to define morality in terms of consequences leading to happiness and attempts to define morality in terms that have nothing to do with consequences or happiness at all. So long as theology survives as a socially influential force, it can be called in to connect virtue with happiness in a world other than this. But theology itself became more and more the victim of its environment. In a writer like Butler, the appeal to divine providence is reasonably sophisticated. In lesser figures such as Abraham Tucker or Archdeacon William Paley, God has clearly been turned from an object of awe and veneration into a device for bridging otherwise unbridgeable gaps in philosophical argument. But the very crudity of their views helps to make the issue clearer. Tucker, in The Light of Nature Pursued, argued first that men only and always pursue their private satisfactions, and second, that the basic moral rule is that we should all work for the good of all men to increase the amount of satisfaction in the universe, whether it is our own or that of others. His fundamental task, therefore, is to show how men constituted in accordance with his first conclusion could possibly accept his second conclusion as their rule of life. Tucker's answer is that if I so work as to increase the happiness of all men, then God has in fact ensured that all the happiness there was, is, and shall be, is deposited, as Tucker puts it, in the bank of the universe. This happiness God has divided into equal shares, equal because our original corruption makes us all equally undeserving, to be allotted one per person. I become entitled to my share by working to increase the common stock. By so working, I increase that stock and thus my own share. I am, in fact, a partner in a cosmic joint stock enterprise of which God is the unremunerated managing director. Tucker's treatment of happiness as though it were quantitative in the way that money is important. So is his treatment of theology as merely providing additional information that the prudent investor in his own happiness will take into account in calculating his actions. In both he was followed by Paley, who believes that the rule of morality is provided by the divine will and that the motive for morality is our own happiness, and more especially our everlasting happiness. What is crucial about Paley and Tucker is that they are logically committed to the view that if God did not exist, then there would be no reason for being other than entirely selfish. Indeed, they do not so much mark the distinction between vice and virtue as obliterate it. For what we normally call vice or selfishness turns out to be merely imprudent, miscalculated short-term selfishness rather than prudent long-term selfishness. It is so often asserted by religious apologists that religion is a necessary foundation for morality that it is worth insisting upon the relief that one must feel in turning away from the narrow, niggardly, self-interested writings of clergymen such as Paley and Tucker, though not, of course, Butler, to the generous and acute observations of the irreligious and skeptical writer who would have to be accounted the greatest of all English moralists, were he not a Scotsman. David Hume had an unusually attractive character for a moral philosopher. Upon the whole, wrote Adam Smith after his death in 1776, I have always considered him both in his lifetime and since his death as approaching as nearly to the idea of a perfectly wise and virtuous man as perhaps the nature of human frailty will admit. He said of himself that he was a man of mild disposition, of government of temper, of an open social and cheerful humor, capable of attachment, but little susceptible of enmity, and of great moderation in all my passions. Even my love of literary fame, my ruling passion, never soured my humor, notwithstanding my frequent disappointments. His two chief disappointments were the cold reception of the two works which contain his moral philosophy. In 1738, the treatise of human nature fell dead-born from the press. In 1752, the inquiry concerning the principles of morals came unnoticed and unobserved into the world. Hume began under Hutcheson's influence, but while he follows Hutcheson in his rejection of rationalist ethics, the arguments with which he develops his own position are original and far more powerful than anything in Hutcheson. Moral judgments, so Hume argues, cannot be judgments of reason because reason can never move us to action, while the whole point and purpose of the use of moral judgments is to guide our actions. Reason is concerned either with relations of ideas, as in mathematics, or with matters of fact. Neither of these can move us to act. We are moved to act not by this or that being the case, but by the prospect of pleasure or pain from what is or will be the case. It is the passions and not reason which are aroused by the prospect of pleasure and pain. Reason can inform the passions as to whether the object they seek exists and as to what the most economical and effective means of seeking it may be. But reason cannot judge or criticize the passions. It follows without paradox that 'tis not contrary to reason to prefer the destruction of the whole world to the scratching of my finger. For reason cannot in any sense adjudicate between the passions. Reason is and ought only to be the slave of the passions and can never pretend to any other office than to serve and obey them. Footnote: Treatise of Human Nature 2.3.3. We cannot discover the ground for moral approval or disapproval in any distinctions or relations of the kind that reason can grasp. Consider incest in animals or the effect of sapling which destroys the parent oak. We do not judge these as we judge incest in human beings or parasite. Why not? Not because the animals or the tree lack reason to discern that what they do is wrong. For if reason's function is to discern that what is done is wrong, what is done must be wrong independently of discerning it to be so. But we do not judge trees or animals capable of virtue or vice at all. Hence, since our rational apprehension of relations among trees and animals does not differ from our rational apprehension of relations among humans, moral judgment cannot be founded upon rational apprehension. Morality, therefore, is more properly felt than judged of. Footnote: Treatise of Human Nature 3.1.2. Take any action allowed to be vicious, willful murder, for instance. Examine it in all lights and see if you can find that matter of fact or real existence which you call vice. In whichever way you take it, you find only certain passions, motives, volitions, and thoughts. There is no other matter of fact in the case. The vice entirely escapes you as long as you consider the object. You never can find it till you turn your reflection into your own breast and find a sentiment of disapprobation which arises in you towards this action. Here is a matter of fact, but it is the object of feeling, not of reason. It lies in yourself, not in the object. Footnote: Treatise of Human Nature 3.1.1. To have the sense of virtue is nothing but to feel a satisfaction of a particular kind from the contemplation of a character. The very feeling constitutes our praise or admiration. Footnote: Treatise of Human Nature 3.1.2. Who are Hume's targets here? Not only rationalist philosophers such as Malebranche, Montesquieu, and Wollaston, although these are not neglected. In a famous footnote, William Wollaston, the deistic author of The Religion of Nature Delineated, 1722, is singled out for attention. Wollaston was the author of the perverse but ingenious theory that the distinction between vice and virtue, which reason apprehends, is simply the distinction between the true and the false. All wrongdoing is a species of lying, and lying is saying or representing what is false. To call something wrong is simply to say that it is a lie. Stealing is wrong because it is representing what belongs to someone else as belonging to oneself by treating it as if it belonged to oneself. Adultery is wrong because by treating someone else's wife as if she were your own, you represent her to be your own wife. Hume demolishes this theory splendidly, first, by pointing out that it makes the wrongness of adultery to consist in the false impression it gives of one's marital relationships, and so has the consequence of making adultery to be not wrong, provided that I commit it entirely unobserved. And second, by pointing out that, if true, it prevents me from explaining why lying is wrong. For the notion of wrongness has been explained in terms of the notion of lying. Wollaston, in any case, confused lying, which involves an intention to deceive, with simply saying what is in fact false. But Hume is concerned to produce a form of argument which will have a more general application. He wishes to show that moral conclusions cannot be based on anything that reason could establish, that it is logically impossible that any genuine or alleged factual truth could provide a basis for morality. In so doing, he is out to refute theologically based ethics quite as much as rationalism. When Hume was dying, he was called upon by his friend, the pious and lecherous Boswell, who was anxious to see the great skeptic's deathbed repentance. Hume disappointed Boswell by remaining immune to the consolations of either theism or immortality, but Boswell has left a splendid record of their conversation. I asked him if he was not religious when he was young. He said he was, and he used to read The Whole Duty of Man, that he made an abstract from the catalogue of vices at the end of it, and examined himself by this, leaving out murder and theft and such vices as he had no choice of committing, having no inclination to commit them. The Whole Duty of Man was a 17th century work of popular devotion, probably by the royalist divine Alistri. It is full of arguments in which the premises are factual to the effect that God has done something or given us something, and the conclusions are moral, to the effect that we ought therefore to perform some particular duty. So it is argued that whoever is in distress for anything wherewith I can supply him, that distress of his makes it a duty on me to supply him, and this in all kinds of events. Now the ground of its being a duty is that God hath given me abilities, not only for their own use, but for the advantage and benefit of others. Footnote: Whole Duty of Man, Sunday, 13, Section 30. Hume summarizes his case against such arguments in a famous passage. I cannot forbear adding to these reasonings an observation, which may perhaps be found of some importance. In every system of morality which I have hitherto met with, I have always remarked that the author proceeds for some time in the ordinary way of reasoning and establishes the being of a god or makes observations concerning human affairs. When of a sudden I am surprised to find that instead of the usual copulations of propositions, is and is not, I meet with no proposition that is not connected with an ought or an ought not. This change is imperceptible, but is, however, of the last consequence. For as this ought or ought not expresses some new relation or affirmation, 'tis necessary that it should be observed and explained, and at the same time that a reason should be given for what seems altogether inconceivable, how this new relation can be a deduction from others which are entirely different from it. But as authors do not commonly use this precaution, I shall presume to recommend it to the readers and am persuaded that this small attention could subvert all the vulgar systems of morality, and let us see that the distinction of vice and virtue is founded not merely on the relations of objects, nor is perceived by reason. Footnote: Treatise 3.1.1. How did Hume intend this passage to be taken? He has been almost universally read as asserting that there are two classes of assertion, factual and moral, whose relationship is such that no set of factual premises can entail a moral conclusion. This has been held to be a special case of the more general logical truth that no set of factual premises can entail an evaluative conclusion. How are moral and evaluative defined by writers who not only suppose this to have been Hume's point, but also suppose this to be a crucial discovery about the logic of moral discourse? They cannot define either moral or evaluative by means of the notion of not being entailed by factual premises, for if they did, they could not treat the alleged discovery that moral conclusions cannot be entailed by factual premises as more than a tautology of the most insignificant kind. Nor is it plausible to define moral, or even evaluative, in terms of its function in guiding action or not guiding action, if the definition is to enable us to contrast these terms with factual. For clearly, purely factual assertions such as "this house is on fire," or "that fungus which you are about to eat is poisonous," are capable of guiding action. How then are we to understand their contention? Perhaps in the following way. The expression "you ought" has a complex background. It differs from the imperative mood of the verbs to which it is attached in at least two connected ways. The first and fundamental one is that the use of "ought" originally implied the ability of the speaker to back up his "ought" with a reason, whereas the use of the simple imperative does not and did not carry any such implication. The reasons which can be employed to back up an ought are of different kinds. "You ought to do that if you want to achieve such and such," or "you ought because you are a chief, tutor, night watchman to dot dot dot," and so on. Because the "ought" of "you ought" has this backing of reasons, it always has a range of application beyond the person to whom it is immediately addressed, namely, the whole class of persons for whom the reason implied or stated holds good, the class of those who want to achieve such and such, and the class of chiefs in the two examples. This is the second difference between ought and imperatives. In this original situation, what distinguished the moral ought from other uses was the kind of reason implied or given for the injunction. Within the relevant class of reason, there were various species. You ought to do this if you want to live up to this ideal. To be a magnanimous man, a perfect knight, one of the saints, and you ought to do this if you want to discharge your function as a dot 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 are samples. But as shared ideals and accepted functions drop away in the age of individualism, the injunctions have less and less backing. The end of this process is the appearance of a you ought dot dot dot, unbacked by reasons, announcing traditional moral rules in a vacuum so far as ends are concerned, and addressed to an unlimited class of persons. For this ought, the title of the moral ought, is claimed, and it has two properties. It tells us what to do as an imperative does, and it is addressed to anyone who happens to be in the relevant circumstances. When to this use of you ought, the response is, but why ought I? The only ultimate answer is, you just ought, although there may be an immediate form of reply in which some particular injunction is deduced from a general principle containing the same ought. Of this ought, it is clear that it cannot be deducted from any is. And since it is probably in the 18th century that this ought first appears, perhaps it is of this ought that Hume is speaking. But a careful reading of the passage leaves it ambiguous as to whether Hume is asserting that the transition from is to ought needs great care, or that it is in fact logically impossible. Whether he is deducing that most transitions from is to ought have in fact been of fallacious kind, or that any such transition must necessarily be fallacious. Some very limited support for preferring the former to the latter interpretation might be drawn from the fact that, in Hume's own moral philosophy, the transition from is to ought is made and made clearly. But too much must not be made of this, for Hume is a notoriously inconsistent author. Yet, how does Hume make this transition? Hume, as we have already seen, argues that when we call an action virtuous or vicious, we are saying that it arouses in us a certain feeling, that it pleases us in a certain way. In what way? This question Hume leaves unanswered. He passes on to give an account of why we have the moral rules we do have, why it is this rather than that which we judge virtues. The basic terms of this account are utility and sympathy. Consider, for example, the account of justice which Hume gives in the treatise. He begins by asking why we accept and obey rules which it would often be in our interest to break. He denies that we are by nature so constituted that we have a natural regard for public rather than private interest. In general, it may be affirmed that there is no such passion in human minds as the love of mankind, merely as such independent of personal qualities, of services, or of relation to oneself. Footnote, Treatise 3.2.1. If private interest would lead us to flout the rules, and we have no natural regard for public interest, how then do the rules come about? Because it is a fact that without rules of justice there would be no stability of property, and indeed no property, an artificial virtue has been created, that of abiding by the rules of justice, And we exhibit this virtue not perhaps so much because we are aware of the benefit that flows from our observing the rules, as because we are conscious of how much we are harmed by others infringing them. Our long-term benefit from insisting on strict observance of the rules will always outweigh our short-term benefit from breaking them on this occasion. In the inquiry, human nature is exhibited as less self-interested. It appears also that in our general approbation of character and manners, the useful tendency of the social interests moves us not by any regards to self-interest, but has an influence much more universal and extensive. It appears that a tendency to public good and to the promoting of peace, harmony, and order in society does always, by affecting the benevolent principles of our frame, engage us on the side of the social virtues. Footnote: Inquiry Concerning the Principles of Morals. 5.2. But what is clear is that Hume's altered picture of human nature is made to provide the same type of explanation and justification of moral rules. We are so constituted that we have certain desires and needs. These desires and needs are served by maintaining the moral rules. Hence their explanation and justification. In such an account, we certainly begin with an is and end with an ought. On most topics, Hume is a moral conservative. His skeptical views on religion led him to attack the prohibition of suicide, but he is generally the spokesman for the moral status quo. Unchastity in women is more immoral than unchastity in men, for it may lead to confusion over heirs and endangering of property rights. The natural obligation to behave justly is not so strong between princes in their political transactions as it is between private individuals in their social transactions, for the advantage to be gained from abiding by the rules is much greater among individuals within a state than it is among sovereign heads of state. Indeed, Hume is for the most part avowedly engaged in explaining why we have the rules that we do, and not in any work of criticism. Just here lies his weakness. Hume treats moral rules as given, partly because he treats human nature as given. Even though a historian, he was an essentially unhistorical thinker. Feelings, sentiments, passions are unproblematic and uncriticizable. We just do have the feelings which we have. A passion is an original existence, but desires, emotions, and the like do not just happen. They are not sensations. They can, to varying degrees, be modified, criticized, rejected, developed, and so on. But this point is not taken with full seriousness either by Hume or by his successors. Richard Price, a Unitarian minister, was perhaps the most important of Hume's immediate successors. Price argues in his Review of the Principal Questions and Difficulties of Morals, 1757, that moral distinctions are intellectually grounded, just as the rationalists said that they were, and that the apprehension of first principles in morals is not a matter of argument, but of grasping their self-evidence. Ought and other moral terms, likewise, cannot be explained in terms of any state of feeling, partly because I can always ask, ought I to feel like this? If asked to justify my judgments, I can only avoid infinite and vicious regress if I allow that there are some actions that are ultimately approved and for justifying which no reason can be assigned. If asked to explain the concept of duty or obligation, I can only reply that its meaning is evident to any rational being. The basic concepts of right and wrong are simple ideas, not susceptible of further analysis. The only other post-Humean moralist worthy of note is Hume's friend, the economist Adam Smith. Smith, like Hume, appeals to sympathy as the basis of morals. He makes use of a figure who also appears in Hume, the imaginary impartial spectator of our actions, who provides the standard by which they are to be judged. Smith disagrees with Hume on the question of utility. When we morally approve of a man's conduct, we approve of it primarily as fitting or proper and not as useful. The discernment of propriety in our own actions is the guide to right conduct, or rather, we must ask whether the imaginary spectator would judge our actions to be proper.